This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today.
There's enough cashmere out there to recycle that we don't need to have four times as much new being made every year. And so we don't need quite so many goats, so then they won't tear up all the grass and turn Mongolia into a desert.
Dana Thomas, she'll be giving us a sneak preview of her book Fashionopolis and taking us through a few design-minded headlines to boot. Plus,
right now we're in a phase of urbanization, and we look at Lagos to Beijing or elsewhere, your Mexico City, all these places are growing. That's where you need the designers and thinkers to concentrate.
We'll listen back to one of my personal favourites from the past year. Yes, yes, it's an in-depth chat with that oh-so-famous architect and urban planner, Sir Terry Farrell. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24. Do stay tuned. And a very warm welcome to Monocle on Design. We begin today's show with a look at fashion, a business of fast-changing looks and an even quicker turnaround of products. The phenomenon of fast fashion, speedy manufacturing processes and product turnaround has become a major talking point in the fashion industry in recent years, and with sustainability advocate Stella McCartney having recently announced a partnership with the luxury powerhouse LVMH, it's a conversation affecting all sectors of design, not just the high street. Dana Thomas is a Paris-based author and journalist whose books include Gods and Kings, The Rise and Fall of Alexander McQueen and John Galliano, and Gelux, How Luxury Lost Its Luster. Her upcoming new book is Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes, and it's published by Penguin Press. Earlier, Monocle's Tom Hall, this show's very producer, spoke to Dana about the book and some of the other fashion headlines that she's been mulling over.
I started working on this book 3 years ago, and what I realized was what I was feeling as a gentle movement was building up as I was working on it. So it was a bit like writing about a moving target, because every time I wrote about or found out about some new sustainability movement or idea or practice, by the time I got it down in print and we had copy edited and it was all set to go, this wasn't new anymore or it had changed. So I was doing updating until we really did ship to the printer. Because this movement is happening, it took a long time to get into the fashion industry, but now because of millennials coming of age and moving into the business world, it has really picked up speed. And it's picked up speed so quickly that now it looks like I saw this coming, like through a crystal ball. When I didn't, I had an inkling, and that's my newspaper reporting to say, this is growing. But I had no idea that this wave was going to crest right as I was coming out with the book. It really has picked up speed, and it's becoming the thing people talk about in the fashion industry constantly now.
It's interesting that you mentioned, the fact that generations such as millennials are now sort of running fashion, and that's why you've got this mental shift. But I do wonder, I mean, I am only just a millennial, and I think that you might be a generation above that. I mean, what was it in your world that made you aware of looking out for this, as you say, three or so years ago?
Well, that's my reporter's instincts. In fact, I started thinking about it while on the book tour for my first book, Deluxe, back in 2007, when three different people in one day in New York City told me that they were bringing manufacturing back to America. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. We have a rule in journalism that three makes a story. So I opened a file and I started pulling clips when I saw them about reshoring, right shoring. And then it became very clear that it wasn't just bringing back jobs, but it was bringing back jobs to clean factories, smart factories, more high tech, robots, but also bringing back a better, smarter way of doing things, a bit like the movement in the food industry with the rise of organic and farm to table and farmers markets. You know, when I was a kid, there weren't very many farmers markets around. I was lucky. I grew up near the Amish area of Pennsylvania, so we had one, but it was a rare thing in America. And now they're everywhere in major cities. It became clear that this was a trend that was on the rise and fast.
And so let's talk about how this affects design, because, I mean, a lot of these ideas, they sound very conceptual and, we might be talking about a factory in China or a boutique in Paris. But in very real terms, what kind of design practices are you seeing that give you optimism, I guess, for the hope of the fashion industry?
Well, one of my favorites, which I just stumbled across, like I said, when I was clipping and reading stories, and actually a friend of mine in England, in London, flagged me on it, was the founding of English Fine Cottons. This is a cotton manufacturer that's housed in an old 19th century mill, one of those, you know, Arkwrightian era mills of, you know, when the Industrial Revolution was at its worst, with children getting their little hands crushed in machines and the soot that was being churned out of those big towers and, you know, clogging the air and everybody being paid poorly and living in slums. I mean, bad, bad industrial, you know, Oliver Twist-like Industrial Revolution. And they refitted this factory with state-of-the-art technology, machines that are just all computerized and run from a clean room. And so I went and visited it, and it turned out it was the first day of full-on manufacturing and spinning of milling of their organic cotton. And they're only milling organic cotton for the moment. And they're the only ones doing it. It was the first cotton mill to start in decades and decades and decades. And it's the only cotton mill that's running in England. I just had such great hope when I saw that. If I thought they could bring back cotton milling to Manchester and bring it back clean and smart. Yes, there aren't 2,000 jobs, there are 200 jobs, but that's 200 jobs more than there were 2 years ago.
I do wonder, though, about, I guess that you're referring to a fairly small scale operation. I could be incorrect, but perhaps something a little bit more geared to the high end and a bit more craft minded. But I wonder whether one of the most sort of damaging industries and wasteful industries we see is obviously the phenomenon of fast fashion, just these mass produced, poorly paid, poor conditions workers generally not in the Western world. You know, have you seen any design practices which are going to be speaking to that kind of issue?
Well, in fact, that was the beauty of English Fine Cottons. When I was there, they had their first spools of yarn that they had spun and had dyed by a local dyer, one of the few that had stayed open during the offshoring exodus of the 1990s and 2000s. And their first client was Marks and Spencer's. And they were going to be making men's socks for Marks and Spencer. And I was like, this is great. This is just great. Yes, they had to bring in the cotton from other places like they did during Arkwright's era. So I liked the idea of the localization. And I liked that Marks and Spencer decided, you know what, we're not going to have our socks made in Bangladesh or Vietnam or India anymore. We're going to have them made up the road in Manchester. There is, you know, that. But the whole idea of fast fashion itself is a disaster because it's like fast food. And like I said, this book is a parallel to something like Fast Food Nation or The Omnivore's Dilemma, looking at the food industry, because it pushes consummation. It pushes you to buy. It pushes you to buy, consume, and throw away really fast and keep acquiring and acquiring and acquiring. It's about volume. It's about economies of scale. And as long as that keeps happening, we're in trouble because there aren't enough landfills to take all these clothes, and most of them are made of polyester. The most disturbing thing I've read in ages was this week when they said they found plastic microfibers in the rain in the Rocky Mountains. And the plastic microfibers, the greatest contributor to plastic microfibers is polyester clothing. And every time we wash a polyester item in our washing machine, microfibers, fleece included, even if it's been made of recycled bottles, the microfibers go into the water and they go into the system, and now we're eating them. And it's raining on our plants. So we can have an organic garden, but it's going to be filled with microfibers. So it's really, we have to get off of that. And to get off of that, we have to stop consuming clothes like fast food. We have to, you know, the average garment is worn 7 times before it's thrown away. And I heard in China, it's 3 times. This idea of dressing, consuming, buying clothes and having a linear life of buying, you know, it's made, we buy it, we wear it, we toss it, must stop. We must move into a more circular idea and preferably with less plastic materials.
What are some of the kind of exciting areas? I mean, I see that you've been writing about 3D printing of clothes and, you know, clean denim and things like that. What kind of design elements are you seeing which, if perhaps not yet ready for the mass market, are definitely on the cutting edge of new ways that we might design clothes?
Well, there are a few different ways of approaching sustainability and fashion that I find heartening. One of them is like Stella McCartney has her EP&L, which is an environmental profit and loss. And they crunch the numbers and they see where their impact is the greatest and then they work to reduce it. So one of the things she did was they saw this, their greatest impact was actually with cashmere, because the cashmere industry is just a disaster in Mongolia. There are too many Mongolian goats, in large part to keep up with the demand from fast fashion of cashmere sweaters, which they sell now for 60, 70 pounds a pop and are worn out in 18 months and you need a new one. And so to do that, the number of cashmere goats has quadrupled in a very short time on the same amount of grass, and it's causing desertification because, as I write in the book, those goats are voracious and they tear up the grass from the roots. So Stella saw that she could crunch down that impact number by using either recycled cashmere or offcuts. Rather than always just sourcing new cashmere all the time, she's putting it back into, she's using it in a circular manner. Her numbers dropped from something like 98 to 2 for the rate of impact. And she's hoping that more people will follow up on it. That basically we can have enough, there's enough cashmere out there to recycle that we don't need to have four times as much new being made every year. And so we don't need quite so many goats, so then they won't tear up all the grass and turn Mongolia into a desert. Some of the other things I've seen that are very cool is growing leather in laboratories at Modern Meadows, in Modern Meadow in New York City and now in New Jersey. They're growing leather out of DNA, which makes Stella McCartney happy because it means no killing of animals. It's grown in a Petri dish and in a vat. But at the same time, it also takes out that unbelievably destructive supply chain of, you know, leather and industrial farming, I guess you would say, of leather, where you have to grow, you have to raise all the animals and slaughter all the animals and then tan all that leather. It's a highly, highly toxic process from beginning to end. But we're creating cleaner, safer jobs that are far less toxic for the people working in them as well. I went to Bangladesh. I went into sweatshops. I saw people sanding and rasping jeans and without masks on and inhaling all those filaments and indigo dust. And that's synthetic indigo that includes things like chemicals like cyanide. This is not a way to go forward. I saw another company called Genealogia that does distressing of jeans with lasers in clean rooms, and it's run from a clean room by a computer, so you don't have to inhale all the dust. There's a vacuum that sucks up all the dust. There are better ways of making our clothes, and we need to embrace them and support them.
Dana Thomas there, and do look out for her upcoming book, Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes, which is out this September and published by the fine folks at Penguin Press. You're listening to Monocle on Design. In a moment, we'll be hearing from the architect Sir Terry Farrell. You don't want to miss that. Sir Terry Farrell was born in Manchester in 1938 and grew up in Newcastle. From the 1960s onward, the architect and urban planner enjoyed a fruitful partnership with Sir Nicholas Grimshaw for 15 years before setting up his own firm, Farrell's. Since then, his postmodern buildings have polarised the public. Vast structures such as the MI6 headquarters and Charing Cross train station in London often rub up against the traditional buildings that surround them. Over a 50-year career, Farrell's reputation as an urban planner and thinker have grown, while his buildings and master planning projects can be spied from London to Beijing and Guangzhou. I had the good fortune to meet Sir Terry back in February 2019 and sat down with the maestro himself here at Midori House in London. We began by talking about what first inspired him to become an architect.
I got the impression that it's a fairly well-worn path. I was very keen on drawing and painting, and I used to paint landscapes and so on. And I was ill at home. And my mother was fed up because one of her boys, I was one of four boys, was at home. And she had persuaded me, or tried to persuade me, to go to apply to the civil service like her father.
A sensible job with a pension and a career progression.
Yes. And she argued with me that I could paint in the evenings and draw. And then I started drawing because I was invalid at home. I started drawing the house opposite. And she said, why don't you be an architect? And I looked up what an architect was. And I went to work. My art teacher organized for me to go to work in an architect's office that summer. and I was hooked.
So of those two places, Manchester and Newcastle, they have a very particular vernacular, a particular look. Is that something that you kind of imbibed when you were younger, that you took in from around you, these industrial cities, these beautiful structures? Or is it something you reacted against, do you think?
No, I loved at the time Manchester, which I don't remember very much about because I was 8 when I left there. I grew up in Newcastle. I identify with Newcastle, and that's an extraordinary city.
And you obviously, which we'll talk about a little later, went on to do a lot of work in Newcastle, but
yes.
From master planning to the beautiful Life Centre there. But what I'd like to talk to you about is education and where education and architecture cross over. You were lucky enough to have a kind of lightning bolt of inspiration that it was a career path that you wanted to follow. But do you think enough children are encouraged to think about the built environment or to make the leap from painting to architecture, as you did?
And particularly in the what you might call the working classes and the lower middle class. It's a posh profession, is architecture. You need a moneyed client, and you tend to be old during your life, not doing the ordinary. And I think my bequesting the archive to Newcastle University, which I'm doing, will be an incentive for boys and girls, people like me, that will come from that kind of background.
So do you think we need to encourage a wider range of voices to talk about the city and to talk about architecture? You mentioned different classes, but I suppose different ethnic minorities, and the imbalance of, I suppose, women who are architects as well. Do we all need to talk and have these urgent conversations about the city?
We need to have people involved in the environment, environment-making and city-making, who are from the broadest spectrum of the population, because the architects are just a fraction. They do just a fraction of what's needed and what city making is about. They do a small posh spectrum.
I tend to agree with you. I'm going to ask you to fast forward. We've spoken a little bit about your childhood, but when you graduated, you took a bit of a plunge, a rather brave one, to work for yourself, not to go and work in the office of a well-known architecture practice, but to seek commissions on your own and do things under your own steam. If you could go back to that time now, what would you tell yourself? What advice would you give to you?
I have no idea, really, about what I would do right now. But I did then, in the 60s, just after I'd finished college, I was invited by a middle-class, well-heeled person that I'd befriended, Nick Grimshaw, to undertake a project for his uncle. And I set up from that point. And I only lasted 6 months working for someone else.
I feel like you're being very modest and putting it down to the luck of the commissioning, but it must have taken some drive, I suppose, and some grit to think to yourself, well, actually, I'm going to do this on my own. I have a strong enough opinion about what I do and a faith in my ability to, you know, to run your own practice.
Well, I'm unusual. I am the only one of my generation that earned his keep as he went. I relied upon designing and architecture as my sole source of income. And I have 5 children, and I moved homes, and the children all had comfortable homes and so on. And I earned it from architecture, which is unusual.
And is there any advice? We live in a world where the notion of entrepreneurship is kind of fetishized to some extent. Everyone has a project that they're working on, an idea that they'd like to bring to fruition. But what advice would you give after all the years that you've, as you say, run your own business, to people that are starting out today? Or is the landscape so different?
I think the mold needs to be broken. It's got to be rewarding and financially having some incentive to work for other than libraries and art galleries or property developers, it's got to be, the mould has got to be broken so that people are working where they're needed in this field. If you look around you, the streets and the houses and the hospitals are solely in need of design and dedication of professionals that, whatever they are, you know, whether they're in surveying or landscaping or architecture or planning or engineering, they need to go about making the ordinary, the everyday.
Absolutely. And your vast range of work over these past decades defies description in the short and limited time that we have, from Charing Cross Station to the station in Shenzhen, embassies, factories and master planning projects. But I ask you, Terry, which of these projects do you remember most fondly?
Well, my standard reply is you're asking me to choose between my children.
Absolutely, and to do so in broadcast format so it'll be immortalised.
Yes. I do remember some. They presented particular challenges, and they were the first. The Clifton Nurseries building were the first thing I did in my own right. I split from Grimshaw in 1980. But TVAM, the headquarters of the television breakfast company, was a particular memorable.
So that's the project in Camden that has become so famous since you built it. And I wonder, Terry, are there some buildings that you'd rather forget?
Yes, I think there are some always that maybe I don't feel as proud of, but I won't mention them here.
You're too much of a gentleman for your own good.
Frank Lloyd Wright, I think it was, said that doctors can bury their mistakes, but architects can just grow ivy over them.
We're sitting in London, a city where so much of your work has taken place, where you've obviously lived and thought and taken in all of the things happening. We won't talk about Brexit, but I think we should acknowledge that there is something in the urban fabric that's changing a little bit. Are you optimistic about London's capacity to continue to be a relevant city, just based on its built environment?
London's been very fortunate geographically, and there will always be a major city here. I remember the 70s when it was going down in population, and there was a location of Offices Bureau, LOB, where you couldn't build offices in the centre of London, and you got grants for moving out, and the population went down. All these things will go through phases. Right now we're in a phase of urbanisation, and we look at Lagos to Beijing or elsewhere, your Mexico City, all these places are growing. That's where you need the designers and thinkers to concentrate.
And lastly, you have a tremendous oeuvre of work that is built all over the world, and a kind of lineage of thought and thinking about master planning that would be heeded for generations. But you continue to work, and you have an office in the Far East. Is that where you see the benchmarks of urbanism being for the future? Or is that a market that you feel you can have some more influence on in a less staid way than perhaps London is? Why the fascination with the Far East?
Well, the action is there. Most architects like to live in Hampstead or San Francisco or on Greenwich Village, but the work is elsewhere, because you're changing, you're building new. And most architects wouldn't live in the new. I know very few architects that live in new buildings, because it takes a while to bed down. It needs layers of history to make it a good place.
And are you ever afraid or afeared of being the person to build the new thing?
I build new, and I have to build new. That's the way the economy works for architects. Mind you, I think we should be employed much more to think about the council housing estate of the 60s, the hospital of the 50s, 60s, 70s, the schools. We need to... They aren't employed, architects. There's no money in it, but you need other minds apply themselves to it, because the changes happen all the time.
But you're optimistic about the future of architecture, about the future of the career that you've devoted yourself to for these decades and scaled the heights of?
I think where I'm optimistic is... Yeah, I'm optimistic because where I'm optimistic is that it's spread now. The School of Architecture I was in was an ivory tower for all male. There was one female in the final year, and she left, leaving us all male. There was 120 students in total. Now the School of Architecture is many, many hundreds. In fact, first year is more bigger than the whole school was then, and it's more than 50% female. So I'm optimistic in the sense that we're all getting much more education. They're becoming a flatter line economically. We're all living more comfortable lives.
Architect, urban designer and all-round good man Sir Terry Farrell there speaking to me about his career. That interview was recorded in February 2019. Do track down the original broadcast of On Design, I think it's episode 394, for an extended version of that chat, or head to monocle.com for more. And with regret, that's all we have time for on today's show. Don't forget, if you'd like to hear more design-minded stories, you could always subscribe to our sister show, Monocle on Design Extra, which is available each Thursday. You could, of course, also head to your local newsstand and seek out a copy of the Monocle Summer Weekly, Monocle Magazine, or head to monocle.com/shop for many of our fine, beautifully bound books, too. Monocle on Design was produced by the one and only Tom Hall. It was edited today by May Lee Evans. Thank you, May Lee. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.